Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of interviews with scientists and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, meteor cams, changes in the Arctic, bizarre decisions, and energy audits. Here's a scientist soundbite.
Just like global warming or climate change will happen quicker in the Arctic, or the temperature will rise quicker in the Arctic, the effects of imbalance with nature as it relates to people, I think, will be more profound there as well. There is a real reliance. People need the environment to thrive, and the environment needs good stewardship on the part of people to thrive.
You're listening to Sven Lindblad, founder of Lindblad Expeditions, one of the first companies to introduce ecotourism to the world's remote and beautiful places. Lindblad is on a commission with the Aspen Institute that released a report on changes in the Arctic and how people can best manage it. The report is called The Shared Future. Earth Sky spoke with Lindblad in Washington at the Aspen Institute. Could you maybe explain what is the future that we all share in the Arctic?
Well, first of all, the environment as a whole, and certainly climate change specifically as an issue, is not a national or regional issue. It's a global issue. It affects all of us, and it will affect all of us in one form or another. So the Arctic just happens to be a geography where a lot of these issues or a lot of these effects are happening faster in the Arctic and in the Antarctic. In the polar regions, the heating is happening faster. And that's where a lot of the ice is. And that's where a lot of new territories will develop as a consequence of ice melting. And so, on one hand, it's very, very hard to get people to think in terms of how an effect or a series of effects far, far away from them ultimately will have a significant effect on themselves. And I think the Arctic, is an area where, in aggregate, there are relatively few people compared to many other population centers. But it will have an effect on our future, most definitely and very powerfully.
Yeah, you conveyed the difficulty of understanding, comprehending the changes that might happen, even amongst incredibly smart people here who gathered for this commission. I can imagine that difficulty is even harder for the public, people like me, to understand.
Oh, I think these issues are incredibly complex. And I think the main problem, let's say you juxtapose what's going on with climate change and how it might unravel over time, right? And you compare that to how we're reacting to something like a tsunami in Japan. Well, a tsunami in Japan or wherever it happens to occur is an immediate effect, right? You can see it in dramatic form. And we react to that. Not to get too philosophical, but I think our brains are wired to react to that. We have trouble thinking in terms of things that unfold over time. That's a political problem. That's just the way we're taught or the way our minds work. But to grapple with this problem, you really have to imagine, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years out. And then, that's a moral question as well as a practical question. Part of our responsibility is to leave this planet in certainly not worse and hopefully better shape for future generations. Well, if we actually mean that, we have to face this issue.
Right, so we've been talking about how humans are changing the Arctic in many ways. What opportunities do you see now in the Arctic to protect the environment?
Well, first of all, if we can get our arms around, as a global community, that the health of natural systems in the Arctic matter a great deal, and the health of keeping these systems intact, which means we have to change our behavior in a lot of other areas, is important, then that's an opportunity. I mean, the Arctic can be an incredible stage set to communicate and to make people understand that this stuff really, really matters. And so, to me personally, that's the greatest opportunity. I mean, there are lots of opportunities envisioned by people in terms of mineral opportunities and fisheries opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. I have a real personal conflict about that, about to what degree is that appropriate, where are the balances there, what is the relationship of short-term human needs and long-term integrity of a place. It's a very, very, very hard question to try and figure out where you stand. Because I think environmentalists or people that have cared deeply about the environment have occasionally portrayed themselves as inadvertently as being anti-human, and I don't think that's a winning strategy. I mean, people have to be able to develop, they have to be able to, you know, develop aspirations, reach those aspirations, use resources intelligently. All we need is balance.
That was Sven Lindblad of Lindblad Expeditions, Where Earth Sky, a Clear Voice for Science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about the global night sky and about space rocks and stardust. Welcome, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. How are you?
Doing great, thanks. So what have you got to tell us?
Well, I corresponded this week with Bill Cook of NASA. He's at Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama, and he is head of NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office. So he and his team study not the kind of space rocks that may in the past have collided with Earth and caused the demise of the dinosaurs and so on, but he mainly is looking at smaller pieces of dust, sometimes chunks of rock that appear as the fiery streaks in our night sky that we know as meteors. And, you know, meteor season is coming up. There's a meteor shower later this month that we'll talk about next week. But for now, he is putting together a system of cameras east of the Mississippi River that he's calling the NASA All Sky Fireball Network.
Awesome. So these are cameras that are looking for meteors that aren't potentially hazardous to people. Maybe tell us more about why scientists are interested in this stuff.
Well, when you see a meteor streaking across the night sky, that may come from a little piece of dust or ice that's entered the atmosphere that was left behind by a comet or that flaked off of an asteroid, or it may be something man-made. There are millions of pieces of stuff now in Earth orbit, and some of that stuff is coming back into the atmosphere.
And from what I understand, some of the things that Bill Cook is doing with this all-sky fireball network of cameras is also kind of looking at the science of how these particles in space interact with our atmosphere.
That's right, because the way that an object, say a meteor, whether that's a piece of space dust or whether that's a hammer or whether that's a chunk of rock, the way that it falls back through the atmosphere and vaporizes due to friction with the air is very similar to what happens when the space shuttle, say, comes back into the atmosphere and its heat shield is heating up and kind of melting, beginning to melt away or ablate, as physicists say. And that process is similar. And so one of the things they're doing here is studying what goes on with natural objects or objects that are just maybe man-made objects that are falling back into the atmosphere with the goal of studying that process of ablation and ultimately to understand more about, you know, how to protect spacecraft re-entering the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, just coming up with better heat shields for spacecraft. And also, from what I understand, some of these rocks in space find their ways through the atmosphere. They're big enough to get through the atmosphere and land on Earth. They can tell scientists a little bit about what's going on outside of Earth.
That's right. There are meteorite hunters who are constantly on the lookout for objects that may have entered Earth's atmosphere and actually made it all the way to the ground. And again, we're not talking here about objects that are large enough to cause any kind of damage to Earth. These are just chunks of rock. And if you've ever been to, say, the American Museum of Natural History in New York, they have a whole room full of these meteorites. They're very beautiful and interesting to look at because, of course, they've been partially melted away. But these cameras in the All Sky Fireball Network, according to Dr. Cook, will help people locate these space rocks that land on the ground more easily and give us more information about the space environment. And Jorge, by the way, you and I are talking today on April 6th, 2011, and some cool asteroid news happened today. That is, two asteroids, one this morning and one actually within the past hour, flew very close to Earth, within the distance of the moon. So whenever an asteroid flies within the moon's distance, that's a notable event. But today we had two.
I mean, it seems kind of scary to me.
It's a little unsettling. It's a little unsettling. But, you know, it happens occasionally, and so far so good.
Right. But there's no danger posed by these two asteroids that were just recently found to be coming between the Earth and the Moon.
It's just an event that happens every so often. And of course, astronomers are watching for objects that may be on a collision course with Earth. And at this moment, none are known.
And I'm glad somebody's watching for these space rocks out there to keep us safe.
You're right, Jorge. Space rocks, stardust.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky broadcast on 1,200 stations around the world. Today on Weird Science, Ryan Britton is here to tell us about a couple of psychological studies on some bizarre ways we humans make decisions. Ryan, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks. So I know that people make strange choices all the time. Mm-hmm. What additional weirdness can you add to the decisions that we humans make?
Well, there are a couple of recent studies just released that show that certain factors that you might not think, you know, influence important decisions and judgments actually influence greatly. The first one was done in the Netherlands, and it took a look at decision-making on a full bladder. Participants in this study were asked to drink 5 cups of water, so that's a lot of water, and then they were asked such questions as, would you choose to receive $16 tomorrow or $30 in 35 days, so a little bit farther out? Those on a full bladder chose the $35 in 35 days more often than the control group that, you know, had a relatively empty bladder. So, you know, holding it or, and I really like this, needing higher levels of bladder control, as the study put it. This seems to cut down on a person's impulsive behavior and make them rely more on rationale.
So to avoid those impulse buys, maybe drink a bunch of water if you want to make a good decision.
Right, right. Or drink a bunch of water if you want to focus more on your rationale when making a decision. So you can find this study at the journal Psychological Science, and that's at psychologicalscience.org.
So Ryan, tell us about that other study.
Right. In related news, there's a recent study by the City University of New York that they basically decided to see how much moral judgment was linked to taste. So participants were either given a sweet beverage or they were given a bitter, disgusting beverage, and they were asked to sort of drink it in one shot. And the researchers then had them rate various kinds of moral transgressions, such as, you know, a politician accepting a bribe, a man who's eating a deceased pet, even a student stealing library books. What they found was that the folks who drank the bad-tasting beverage judged these moral transgressions a lot harder than the folks that enjoyed the sweet-tasting beverage.
So people with a bad taste in their mouths were harsher in their judgments.
That's right. So, you know, I think researchers here had to be testing that cliche. So having a bad taste in your mouth puts you in a bad mood and affects your judgments. Science proves it. So you could find a good abstract on this study at wired.com, by the way.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Beth Lebwohl joins us now to talk about audits. Not for taxes, though, but for energy used in homes and offices. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
So what have you got to tell us about energy audits?
Well, I first heard about Dr. Sanjay Sarma, the engineer I spoke to for this piece, because he participated in a big deal energy conference that was held at MIT in early March of 2011. And what he apparently did, he was presenting results of a citywide energy audit that he conducted during winter nights in 2010, or rather in the winter of 2010, and I was really intrigued. So I spoke to him about it, and he told me exactly what he did.
Yes, we did an energy audit of the city of Cambridge, and it turns out that when a building leaks heat, there is actually a particular frequency of light at which you can see it. It's kind of a color that's beyond our visible range. It's called infrared. And you can quite literally see the outside of the building and see the temperature of the outside of the building. And you can see which parts of the building are hot. And on a winter's day, if the outside of the building is hot, it means the building isn't doing a great job of holding the heat in. You expect the outside to be cold. So what we did is we mounted a bunch of cameras on a car, and we drove around the city of Cambridge, and we recorded most of the houses, images of most of the houses in Cambridge. And those images tell you which houses are leaking energy and, in fact, where in the house they're leaking energy.
So Dr. Sarma used these infrared cameras that could take pictures of the heat coming from buildings.
Yeah, sort of like in the same way that Google Street View works. Are you familiar with that program?
Mm-hmm.
Very similar method, except instead of taking pictures of, let's say, physical reality, it took pictures of heat.
So how does an energy audit work? You have people come to your house, and they knock on your door, and then they spend a few hours, they pressurize your house. Actually, they depressurize it, and they look for places where air might be leaking in. They take images from the inside. It takes several hours and a few people. It's expensive. It's expensive and disruptive. Here, it took us a few seconds per house because we basically drove past the house. And our findings are actually quite specific, so we can say, hey, you know, your door sill is leaking, or your window is cracked, or your roof line has a leak. So it's much faster. And now we don't get to see the back of the house, but it turns out that if you see one side of a house, it's like the human body. If you can tell that the body has a certain issue on one side, it's probably pervasive. So it's much faster, much cheaper, and much more specific, actually.
So, Beth, Dr. Sarma, he did this energy audit of Cambridge and came up with how much energy was these houses and these buildings were losing. And he actually had some interesting results, I gather, that could apply to people listening on how to save money in their own homes.
Well, I think it's more like a philosophy of energy savings that he has. There are certain buildings, especially old buildings, that leak heat all over, right? But then there are other buildings and homes where only a simple fix is required. Maybe just a little addition needs to be made to a roof, or a window needs to be repaired. And those are both very energy efficient and money efficient fixes to make.
Science making energy audits faster. Thanks, Beth. Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, $50 Dynasty, Daniel Webb, The Black and White Years, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.